This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with Paul S. Ryan, the good Paul Ryan. He's the Vice President for Policy and Litigation at Common Cause, commoncause.org. You can tweet him at the Paul S. Ryan. And Paul, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you with us always. So Donald Trump says that his meeting in Trump Tower was perfectly legal. Take this apart for us, please, or explain this to us.
Well, I'll just put it in simplest terms. The president's wrong, and the meeting in Trump Tower between Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort, and others did seemingly violate at least one federal campaign finance law, possibly multiple campaign finance laws. So which law was violated? The law that prohibits soliciting a contribution from a foreign national.
Or a thing of value.
Yeah, I mean, that's the allegation that Common Cause made in a complaint that we've sent to the Department of Justice on July 10th, 2017, so over a year ago. And I think you were just about to get into this. The term contribution in the law is defined to mean anything of value given for the purpose of influencing an election. Here we know that going into that meeting, Trump Jr., Donald Trump Jr., was told that he was going to be given information that would be damaging to Hillary Clinton, opposition research information. And this type of information, Oppo research, is regularly bought and sold by political players at every level of politics. It is definitely something of value, and Donald Trump Jr. and the campaign asked for that free Oppo research on Clinton in this Trump Tower meeting.
There are reports that it was actually in the public domain. It was on Twitter, and there were some news stories in relatively obscure publications, but this was, you know, before any of this stuff came out, that the Russians had Hillary's emails, that they were going to leak this stuff, that, you know, get ready, you know, et cetera. What's the timeline here? What does this say about, you know, conspiracy to defraud the United States? Conspiracy to commit the crime of violating the campaign laws by taking a thing of value from a foreign actor, that sort of thing. What do we know about what has happened?
Well, we don't know whether or not Team Trump did in fact receive something of value from the Russians during that Trump Tower meeting or as a result of that meeting. If Team Trump did, and there's pretty good reason to at least believe they may have and to conduct a thorough investigation, then that opens the door to several other violations of federal law, including other provisions of the Federal Election Campaign Act, as well as provisions of the criminal code. So what are those additional violations? I already mentioned violation number one that looks like it occurred regardless of whether they got anything of value. That's the ban on soliciting a contribution from a foreign national. If they, in fact, received something of value, hacked emails that were stolen from the Clinton campaign or the DNC, or any other valuable campaign material, we're looking at additional violations of receiving an illegal foreign national contribution. That's a violation of the campaign finance laws. And failing to report a receipt of an in-kind contribution, another violation of the Federal Election Campaign Act. And it's that failure to report that opens the door to other prosecution for other crimes, including, for example, the one you just mentioned, conspiracy to defraud. Now, the Department of Justice has historically relied on that crime, conspiracy to defraud, to include instances in which a candidate or other political player has tried to mislead the Federal Election Commission or obstruct the FEC's enforcement of laws like the ban on foreign national contributions. So filing an incomplete disclosure report with the FEC, that is subject to a charge of conspiracy to defraud. There are a couple other criminal statutes that prohibit lying to the federal government. And we also have attempted conspiracy counts that could be thrown on top of all of these. So, you know, by my math, that gets us to, if they in fact received something of value from the Russians to influence the campaign, at least six different counts of federal law violations.
Wow. And so, correct me if I'm on my timeline here, if I'm wrong on this, but my recollection is, well, actually, it was either, there was a meeting, there was an event on July 7 and an event on July 9, and I don't remember which one was the meeting in Trump Tower and which was Trump telling an audience that any day now he was going to be releasing, that in a week or two he was going to hold a press conference and release dirt on Hillary. But he never held that press conference. He never did that. But the stuff came out from Guccifer and, you know, via WikiLeaks and all that. So what if they had this meeting and said, and you know, the Russians said, okay, we've got this information for you. And say somebody who actually had some understanding of the election laws. I don't know if Paul Manafort qualifies as that. I doubt Jared Kushner or Don Jr., but maybe, said, well, that's cool, but don't give that information to us because that's a clear violation of federal law. Instead, just release it, you know, via WikiLeaks or out to the press, because that's what happened. Would that minimize their liability?
I don't think so. It makes the case a little bit more complicated, but the scenario you're setting up would be the Trump campaign suggesting to the Russians that they disseminate this information independently, kind of,
or vice versa. I mean, it's possible that the Russians said to the Trump campaign, you know, we know campaign finance law, and you don't want to get yourself in trouble here. Let us do this.
So the important point here legally is that if there's actual coordination, if there's conversations between a candidate and an outside group, Russians or an outside political spender, about how the outsider will release info or do something helpful to the candidate, that means that's no longer independent. That is treated under the law as if they'd given the something of value directly to the campaign. This coordination turns independent political activity into an in-kind contribution to the campaign, subject to the same restrictions as if the Oppo research had been given directly to the Trump campaign. And
right.
I want to mention one other thing, because you're mentioning who might have, whether or not these folks in the room had knowledge of these federal campaign finance laws. I'll tell you, note who was involved with the campaign, who knew all about the campaign finance laws. The campaign's general counsel, Don McGahn. He was the former chairman of the Federal Election Commission, and today he is White House counsel. I cannot imagine that he would not be involved in these high-level decisions around campaign activity, nor can I imagine that he did not brief the high-level campaign staff at the very least about the rough requirements of federal campaign finance law, and not taking contributions from foreign nationals. That's campaign finance law 101.
So this might have been Don McGahn's bright idea to pass along, which raises another, feel free to react to that, but it also raises another interesting question, which is, if Donald Trump's tweet is correct, and that tweet just blew my mind, you know, because I remember when Michael Flynn, when they were closing it, Michael Flynn had hired his son, or his son was involved in his consulting company, and his consulting company was all tied up in this whole Russia-Trump thing. And when Mueller started going after Flynn's son, Mike Jr., Michael Flynn said, hey, don't take out my son. If you stop trying to prosecute my son, I will turn state's evidence. I'll give myself over to you. You send me to jail instead of my kid. Donald Trump, on the other hand, says, yeah, Don Jr. was there. The meeting was about getting this information. And by the way, I knew nothing about it, which says something, I think, about his personality and his ethics and how much he loves his kids. But beyond that, if we were to assume for a moment that Donald Trump actually told the truth in that tweet, that he actually did know nothing about it, what does this mean for Don Jr. and what does this mean for Don Sr.?
Well, it means that if Don Sr. knew nothing about this, then he would not be personally liable for the types of crimes that I've been discussing earlier in our conversation. But the campaign committee is a legal entity. It was represented at this meeting by Don Jr., Kushner, Manafort. They were campaign officials. So the campaign committee itself could quite possibly be found to have violated federal law, and the individuals themselves, as agents of the campaign committee, likewise could be found to violate these federal laws. I want to circle back 1 minute to Don McGahn, because
sure.
You mentioned maybe this was his idea. You know, Don McGahn knows federal campaign finance law inside and out. I don't want to imply that I believe that any of this was his idea. I think that he would probably have given the correct legal advice to his clients, which is don't do any of this. Now,
right.
I think it's very possible that Team Trump ignored that advice, but you know, Don McGahn and I have agreed on almost nothing throughout our careers on campaign finance law and issues, but he knows the law, and I think he would have counseled his clients correctly.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Paul Ryan, the good Paul Ryan, the Vice President of Policy and Litigation at Common Cause, commoncause.org. You can tweet him at @ThePaulSRyan. Paul, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Great talking with you. Fascinating conversation. A lot of stuff to chew on there. A lot to think about. We'll be back with more of the news of the day. And boy, is there a lot of the news of the day. And your calls after this. It's coming up on 16 minutes past the...
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be back with your calls. And welcome back. Let's see. Darlene in Grand Prairie, Texas, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Darlene, what's on your mind today?
Well, a lot of things are on my mind. But today, you have the question, do you regret voting for Trump? The real topic should be, do you regret not voting?
Yeah, because that's truer. That's true of a much larger cohort.
Exactly, because I don't think Trump voter is going to ever regret it until it really hits him in the face.
Yeah.
But the real problem are the non-voters.
Yeah, like this. The Trump voters are, you know, to your point, like the guy who just had his wife, the Trump voter, the Trump enthusiast, the former military, you know, the veteran who just had his wife deported. And he's like shocked. Oh, my God, I didn't realize that Trump was going to do that.
Yeah, well, they don't listen to him anyway.
Apparently.
But I'm still wrestling with, why did these people not vote?
Well, there was a large and active campaign to encourage Democrats not to vote. You know, to say that, oh, Hillary Clinton is just a shill, or she's just this or just that, and you know, they're equally corrupt, and you know, Tweedledum, Tweedledee, et cetera, et cetera. And we were hearing this from the left. I was not saying this, but you were hearing this from some people on the left, and apparently we were hearing this from the Russian Internet Research Bureau posts on Facebook and Twitter all over the place. So I think some people just internalized that. And a lot of people voted green. I mean, you know, the Green Party, I don't know that it beat the margin of victory in any of those states, but it certainly didn't help. And this is why I loved it when David Cobb ran for president on the Green Party ticket. I think it was in 2004. And he said, if you live in a swing state, vote for the Democrat. If you live in a solidly red or solidly blue state where your vote is not going to have that much impact, feel free to vote for me. And, you know, that made sense to me. I thought David ran an ethical campaign, but Jill Stein did not do that. Ralph Nader did not do that. And ultimately, Ralph Nader not doing that hurt us in Florida and gave George Bush the presidency, some would say. Ralph would say, no, it wasn't that. It was voter suppression, I agree with.
I don't even think it was Florida's fault for getting Bush elected.
If the Supreme Court
had won his home state, he would have won, and he didn't even need Florida.
Yeah.
But he lost Tennessee, so I blame Tennessee.
Well, I think you could blame Al Gore, actually. If Al Gore had not picked Joe Lieberman as his vice president, who, you know, was just an open neoconservative Republican light, and if he had not refused to take any help from Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton at that point had an over 60% popularity rating, but Al Gore was offended by the fact that he'd had sex with an intern in the White House. Al's sentiments and Tipper's sentiments apparently were very, very offended by that, which is, you know, pretty unfortunate, I would say. Had that not happened, then I think that you would have different circumstances. So. Anyway, we'll see. Darlene, thanks for the call. Al Gore did not run a brilliant campaign, unfortunately. He was a decent candidate and a decent man. I've met Al Gore, talked with him at some length, and he kind of redeemed himself with his climate work. But whoever was advising him on that campaign, particularly whoever advised him to put Joe Lieberman on the ticket with him, turned off a lot of potential voters. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We were talking about we will get to that. Oh, the neoliberal assault on Canadian Medicare. I wanted to get into this for a minute, and then I'll pick up your phone calls after the break at the bottom of the hour. Lambert Strether is writing over at nakedcapitalism.com, which sounds a little risque, but it's not. It's actually a really great progressive website for economists, for progressive economists and progressive economics. And there is a playbook that neoliberals use, and both in the Republican and Democratic Party, and particularly neoliberals in the media, there is an actual playbook that they use to take us from publicly funded programs to privatized programs. whether it's the electric grid, you saw this played out with Enron in California, whether it is the water system, whether it's the septic systems, whether it's public schools, whether it's public health care, whether it's the Veterans Administration, whether it's the Social Security Administration, whether it's the post office. You see all these things that we all collectively pay for, that we all collectively want to be produced for the benefit of all Americans at the lowest possible cost, and without the profit motive, because these are things that affect all of our lives. These are things that directly have to do with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, as opposed to just getting stuff. You know, I've said a million times on this program, well, probably a couple hundred thousand times on this program, I don't want the government making my jeans, I don't want them making my shoes, I don't want them making my car. You know, I lived in Germany. I remember the Ladas made in Russia and the Trebis made in East Germany. And they were terrible cars, right? These little three-cylinder cars in East Germany, you know, going down the street, just, you know, blowing smoke out the back because they were two-cycle engines. I don't want the government doing any of that stuff. There is an entirely and large and appropriate place for private industry in the United States. But I don't want the profit motive sitting between me and the water coming out of my tap, sitting between me and the electricity coming into my house, sitting between me and the septic system that goes out of my house, sitting between me and my health care, sitting between me and my internet connection, sitting between me and my schools, and sitting between me and my post office. Those are all things that we have, for a long time in America, had a broad consensus should be part of the commons, the stuff that we all own and we all use, the stuff that is essential for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But the neoliberalism playbook is very, very specific. Number one, and here's how, in the classic example that we're watching right now, of a neoliberal train wreck happening right now as I speak, is with Social Security and Medicare. And it happened last year when the Republicans passed this tax bill and this piece of a budget bill that cut funding for the Social Security Administration and Medicare. Not for your benefits. They didn't cut your benefits yet, but they cut the staff of Social Security and Medicare. And the reason they did that was so that the service that you get when you call Social Security and Medicare sucks. Right? So step one in the neoliberal playbook is defund the program, reduce the funding for the program, break the program, wreck the program, demoralize the people who are administering the program, cut resources to the people who are administering the program, force them into a frenzy, you know, just, oh my God, I've got so much work to do. I can't even take your phone call right now. I'm sorry. That kind of thing, right? Number one, defund or sabotage the program. We saw this with the post office. In 2005, the Congress passed the Postal Reform Act, and literally the night before this was passed, in the night, a Republican slipped into that bill, and we still don't know who it was, slipped into that bill this provision that said that the post office had to start setting aside $5 billion a year, starting in 2005, set aside $5 billion a year for 10 years to pay for the health insurance costs of postal workers who retire 75 years after 2005. In other words, in 2080. There's no reason for this. It's never been done before with any government agency. It's never been done in private industry. There's absolutely no reason for it. The post office is now sitting on $50 billion in a savings account that they can't spend until 2080. Now, why did they do this? To dramatically damage the service of the post office. The post office in 2005, when they passed this law, was on the verge of electrifying their entire fleet. But they had to break it. They had to break the post office first. And then they could call for step two. They could say, there's a crisis. Oh my God, there's a crisis. Social Security's in a crisis. Look at the long wait times and they're doing this, by the way, with the Canadian healthcare system right this minute. Oh my God, look at these long wait times in Canada. Well, actually, they're not. But, you know, this is, so declare the crisis. Number three, call for privatization. Oh, we've got to have privatization. This is what they did with the Veterans Administration. They said, veterans, the VA is not taking care of our veterans in a timely fashion. This is after years of cutting funding for the Veterans Administration. The VA is not or not keeping up with the demands of the Veterans Administration as a result of the two wars that George Bush lied us into, Bush and Cheney. They said, oh my God, there's a crisis. The Veterans Administration, we're not going to give them enough money to serve people. Then they said, oh my God, there's a crisis. People aren't being served. Then they said, let's privatize part of the functions. And President Obama actually went along with this, right? I mean, you know, we gave people these vouchers so that they could go to private practitioners. And then number four, profit, ka-ching, we're making money off what should be a public function. Whether it's public universities, public schools, the post office, the TSA, in Britain, the National Health Service, this exact same playbook is being played out, and big time in Canada. In fact, I got to share with you a really funny thread right after the break, and then we'll pick up your phone calls. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Speaking the truth, the multinational corporations and the neoliberals would rather you didn't know. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I'll get to this these tweets on Medicare, on Canadian Medicare, in just a moment, because we've got a couple of Republicans who called in to talk about voting for Trump. Dennis in Safety Harbor, Florida, listening on Sirius XM. I promise to be decent to you, Dennis. What's up?
Well, first off, I want to thank you for taking my call. I am a Republican. Have been pretty much ever since my grandmother sat me down and said, you're a Republican.
Uh-huh.
You know, so many times I try to get a liberal point of view, and so many of the media outlets, friends, family, whatnot, they just all seem to fall short. And I wanted to compliment you and say that you're the first person that I've heard, and this is the first time I've heard your program, but you come across as educated, well-informed, and truly just trying to present facts as you see them.
Well, thank you.
I want to thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. So tell us about voting for Trump and your thoughts on it.
Well, I did vote for Trump, and I do stand behind that. And part of the reason is, and you know, with my comment about trying to get a liberal point of view on things, so much of what we hear in the media just comes across as irrelevant to us. And I'm speaking for myself, but I know that I represent many people in this thought, you know, because we hear that Trump is a racist and that he's immoral and things of that nature. And it comes across as irrelevant to us because we can look at times in, you know, in the past where, okay, so he's immoral. You know, this whole thing with Stormy Daniels and whatnot, but why is it important now but not when Clinton was in office? Mm. Or he's a racist. And, you know, but then there's Hillary's long-term mentor. And so a lot of this stuff just comes across as irrelevant.
Who's Hillary's long-term mentor who's a racist?
I don't remember his name, and forgive me because I'm terrible with names, but
sure.
From what I understand, he was a member of the KKK. There was an interview that I had seen of him where he was talking along those lines.
Yeah.
And God, I have no idea. Apologize.
Yeah, that's okay, Dennis. I have no idea who you're talking about, but I'm guessing that that's a story that was kind of confined to the Fox newsosphere. It wouldn't have been Robert Byrd. He died quite a while ago, and he repented, basically. But anyhow, back to you, Dennis.
Well, thank you. My point, though, is so we see these things, and it comes across as irrelevant, but then we also see things like Maxine Waters, you know, basically saying to harass people. There was an interview of a lady on TV yesterday saying, you know, they say that we're socialists, let's give them socialism. Mm. And, you know, and we hear, you know, open the borders. And so much.
Well, hang on just a second, Dennis. Can you name one Democratic politician in the last 30 years who has called for open borders? There's not. Here's a clue. There's not one. There are a number of Republicans who have taken that position because it is the official libertarian position. There should be no borders. There should be open access of both money and people, both business and persons, to all countries. That's the libertarian position, and there's a large libertarian cohort in the Republican Party, including Rand Paul. But you will not find a Democrat who's ever said that. But you know, but I digress. And I get what you're saying here is that it sounds like a lot of the debate has been turned into basically a cartoon debate. And I mourn that, too. It also sounds to me like what you're saying, Dennis, and I'm not trying to suggest that there's that you're being explicitly racist about this, but that the racism of Donald Trump, and I'm not talking about his past, I'm talking about his current actions and behaviors, is not a great concern to you because you're a white guy.
Absolutely not. It is. I'm saying that this is the way it comes across in the media, and when you couple that with the last few points that I made, mm-hmm. it comes across as just scary. Yeah. And I would very much like your position on these things because, like I said, you are very much coming across as educated and truly trying to inform. And I'll be honest with you, I look forward to listening to your program again.
Well, thank you, Dennis. You know, having conservatives on my program is one of my favorite things to do, actually, and Republicans. With regard to the border, I'm right there with the entire Democratic Party, which is that our country needs a strong immigration policy or comprehensive immigration policy, and we need strong borders that are enforced. We don't necessarily need a wall. The caveat that I'd throw on this is that, and because you haven't listened to the program before, you haven't heard me say this 1,000 times like most of our listeners have, but my position on that is that we don't have an illegal immigration problem in the United States. We have an illegal employer problem in the United States. We've had an open border with Mexico for 240 years, and by and large open up until basically the last 40 or 50 years. And you had people coming north during the picking season, and in fact, Eisenhower even tried the program called the Bracero program, where they gave these people a card, basically, you know, permit to enter the country for up to 6 months to pick crops in California and Oregon and whatnot, and then they would go back south and go back to be with their families with a pile of cash. And, you know, you'd have about 500,000 people coming to the United States every year and about 500,000 people leaving at the end of the picking season. That went on for, 70 years. And then what happened, but beyond agriculture, there was no invasion of American industry, to use language that, you know, is kind of a variation on Trump's language. There was no invasion of American industry by people who were not legal citizens outside of agriculture. And there were specific exemptions in the law for agricultural workers, in fact, that would be like the Bracero program. But there was also a very strong law, and this was put into place in the 1880s, about the ability and reinforced in the 1930s about the ability of the government to prosecute employers who hire people who are not legal citizens or don't have legal, you know, don't have a green card, don't have a legal right to work in the United States. And up until 1986, the United States government routinely threw employers in jail who hired people who were not here legally. And that's why the construction industry was entirely unionized. You know, building houses all over the country, entirely unionized. It was one of the best jobs you could get. One of my brothers was a union roofer and a union electrician. The meatpacking industry was entirely unionized, and they had, you know, they did so well and they made so much money, these workers, that the union meatpacking workers in Wisconsin got together and built their own NFL team. It's called the Packers. It's the only NFL team in the country that's not owned by a billionaire. It's owned by the community, and it originally was owned by union members. But what happened was in 1986, when Ronald Reagan gave amnesty to 5 million people, that wasn't the big thing that he did with his so-called immigration reform. The big thing he did was he officially stopped prosecuting employers. And so for the last 30 years, you've got meatpacking plants in Minnesota and construction sites in Las Vegas and other industries all over the United States who literally are placing Spanish language ads in tabloid newspapers that are being passed out for free on the Mexican side of our southern border. They're help wanted ads. If you can get to this city in Wisconsin, you've got a job. And those union jobs that used to pay the equivalent of maybe $30 an hour in today's money are now paying $12 an hour, or $8 an hour, or $7 an hour, $7.25 an hour. So we need to start putting employers in jail again. And Trump is not doing this. You know, when he did that big, well-publicized bust of 7-Eleven, who went to jail? The workers. The guys who owned the franchises? Nope. 7-Eleven? Nope. No fines, no penalties. Maybe there were some fines, but, you know, basically nobody went to prison. When we start putting rich white guys in jail again, you're going to see these formerly unionized industries come back. So I don't remember the other topics that you were raised, Dennis, but that's my take on immigration.
Well, I want to thank you because this definitely gives me something to study up on. Once again, thank you.
You're welcome. Dennis, thanks for the call. It's great talking with you, and I look forward to future conversations. Bob, listening on Sirius XM in Montana. Hey, Bob, you voted for Trump?
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
For taking my call. I'm a big Trump supporter. I just, more on the economic front. Us in Montana here, the unemployment rate is under 3%.
So you're liking the ninth year of the Obama expansion?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I just think that, you know, Obama did good at the end, but when Trump got in, everything accelerated on the business front twofold. We have the greatest economics that this country's ever seen. And I'm a numbers guy. I'm not a feeling.
Okay, so question for you, Bob. If the economy crashes in the next 12 to 16 months or 18 months, are you still going to support Trump?
It's not. It's not going to crash.
Right, but let's just a hypothetical. I'll stipulate it's not going to crash. It's going to last forever, or at least until Trump leaves office. But if it does, would that cause you to question your support for him?
It's going to be a 15-year boom here.
Well, I hope so, because a lot of people get hurt when the economy crashes. But if it were to crash, would that cause you to question your support for Trump if you're kind of a single-issue voter here on the economy?
Well, obviously, yeah. Then I would have to look back at what caused the crash. You know, was it the tax cut?
Yeah.
Changing the tax laws, or was it, you know, is the deficit, you know, $21 trillion in deficit?
Yeah, he just added $1.5 trillion to the deficit for this year.
Oh, yeah, I know, yeah. But yeah. Obama, what did we do with Obama? $9 trillion over the 8 years? You know, we're still on that pace.
I don't think it was that much, but yeah, absolutely right. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan really hurt us badly. Bob, thank you for the call. It's good talking to you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check in with Talk Media News in about 4 minutes. And, the program rolls on. Stick around. And welcome back. Louise in Portland. Or excuse me, Bruce in Portland, watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
All right. I'm reminded of this frustration constantly. It's like, for example, you had a caller named Jesse who listed all the unprecedented climate catastrophes that we're experiencing. And we get up to that point of listing all these things, and we don't take that extra step and say, well, every time you turn your car on, you're creating greenhouse gases. Every time you get in an airplane, you're doing it. All the free trade in the world is by ships. I mean, we're really deep into fossil fuels.
Yeah.
My point would be, go renewables. It will pull the rug out from under Trump and the Koch brothers and all of those fossil fuel people.
I agree with you, Bruce. I'd like to recalibrate your message slightly, and you tell me what you think of this. My concern is that when you say, oh, it's you driving your car, or you flying on an airplane, basically what we're doing is blaming the victims. We're also the victims of climate change. And it's not like I have a choice. If I want to, you know, go visit my kids, I have to drive in my car. If I want to go visit my brother, I have to get on an airplane. There's just no other way to do it. Well, actually, I could drive, but the airplane is far more fuel efficient, you know, as a way to get from here to Michigan, for example. So, what we need are policy changes. And I absolutely agree with you, it needs to be renewables. But that has to be driven from the government. Right now, we're giving a $300 billion a year subsidy to the oil industry, Which has been going on for almost a century now. You know, not $300 billion, but it's probably in today's in the $1,890. It's the equivalent. We've been giving this huge subsidy. I mean, actual cash out of your and my taxes is given to the oil industry, $300 billion a year. The mining industry, the coal mining industry, getting billions of dollars a year in subsidies. The natural gas industry, billions of dollars a year in subsidies. And this doesn't count. For the oil industry, this doesn't count the cost of protecting the shipping lanes from Saudi Arabia, which is another multiple billions, probably hundreds of billions of dollars a year. And we will not and we're marginally subsidizing anything that's renewable. And basically, what Trump has done is do away with all the subsidies that Obama had put into place. It seems to me like we should be rewarding the stuff that's going to keep us from being destroyed and stop rewarding the stuff that's destroying us.
I'm sorry if I came off like a blamer. I'm just trying to state how deep we are in the use of fossil
fuels. Oh, yeah, your point is well made. I absolutely agree with it.
Like the March on Washington, you know, people weren't doing us a favor by burning all kinds of fossil fuels to get there, even though I support it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real complicated and conflicting thing for me that people aren't, even Naomi Klein, who wrote that beautiful book, She wrote an article in Harper's and also the Sierra Club magazine, and she didn't mention renewables. And somebody should be running down electric vehicles. We have an electric vehicle, and we get all of our electricity in Portland from renewable sources.
Yeah, I do too. And you know, we plug our car in every night, and we love it. Bruce, thank you for the call. I got to run here. We're hitting a break, but we're going to check in with Talk Media News. But thank you very much for your call. We'll be back. It's coming up on 10 minutes before the hour. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman with you. Let's check in with Talk Media News and find out what's going on in the world today. This report brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and Ellen Ratner's new book, Loving What You Do. On the line with us is the chief foreign correspondent for Talk Media News, Luke Vargas, out of New York. You can follow him on Twitter at The Courier. Luke, I see that the world has surpassed a terawatt. Is that a trillion watts in renewable energy generation? Is this a big milestone?
Yes, 1,000 gigawatts. And I apologize in advance if my audio isn't perfect. We haven't done video in a while, and you used to not be able to do the video over the Skype. So
yeah, no, it sounds good, actually.
Okay, good. Well, yeah, so this is a big milestone. 1 terawatt equals the amount of power generated in the United States altogether. So this is a huge milestone. It's also equal to the amount of coal power generation in China. And we are, we're hitting a milestone. This is something that was predicted by Bloomberg New Energy Finance, which is a think tank focusing on renewable energies. They said we would hit this precisely when we did. What we've actually done is sort of beat expectations, because their calculations about 5 years ago about how uptake of renewable energy was going to occur did not think that photovoltaic cells, these solar cells, would be as cheap as they are. And in fact, prices have come down faster than anyone expected, which is a great thing. Of course, you know, we now have President Trump putting tariffs on imported photovoltaic cells, which is going to probably slow down some possible uptick that could have occurred in adoption of solar energy in the United States. But even still, we're doing well. We're hitting these targets. One thing that's really cool here is that basically all economists I've spoken to said 5 to 10 years from now, solar and wind are going to be absolutely compatible, gigawatt for gigawatt. These are, already seeing in certain markets competitive pricing for these renewable technologies, that the prices should be basically even everywhere within 5 to 10 years. And it took us 40 years and $2.3 trillion dollars to get to this first terawatt of renewable energy. The next terawatt is going to cost half as much, and we're going to install it within the next 5 years. So this technology is really accelerating. One problem, as I mentioned, are these Trump tariffs on imported PV cells. And uncertainty, which I think everyone can understand about really if the Trump administration has an all-of-government approach that takes renewable energy seriously. But on the upside, one surprising positive comment coming from the Union of Concerned Scientists when I spoke to them this morning is that the Trump administration has okayed the development of a number of offshore wind farms on various sort of the continental shelf.
Right.
So just like they're putting oil leases out there, though, they have also been unable to deny the, you know, the impact that can be achieved by those offshore wind farms. So some good news here in the U.S. and around the world.
There you go. And meanwhile, Yale has this group for this program called the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. Yep. They've been measuring how Americans understand and think about this whole issue. What can we glean from that?
Yeah, I love the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. They're really good at sort of studying American opinions on a whole range of sort of subset issues to climate change as a headline topic. Mm-hmm. They've surveyed 22,000 people over the course of 10 years, now have a good decade of data here. 70% of Americans nationwide think global warming is happening. That's a great number. It obviously ought to be higher in my view, but we only go down as low as 59% in West Virginia, 60% in Wyoming and North Dakota, and the low 60s in Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Mississippi. As high as it gets is in Washington, D.C. 82% of respondents think global warming is real, 77 in New York, about the same in California, and a little lower in Massachusetts.
Do you suspect that's going to change following this insane summer?
I know. Let me get to what I actually think is the problem here, cool. Which is that 36% of Americans say they discuss global warming at least occasionally. That's worryingly low. And only 22% of Americans, and here's where we come in, hear about global warming in the media at least once a week. I have to say I got a copy of the New York Times Sunday Magazine last week, which dedicated its whole issue to how the decade we failed to stop global warming several decades ago, and then The Economist has their front cover over this weekend saying we're losing the war on climate change. For those of us, you know, taking in certain types of media, I'm sure, you know, we're in that 22%, right, who are hearing about global warming at least once a week. Pretty worrisome, though, that, you know, it's perhaps an echo chamber for us is other people who are just being entirely left out of this. I you know, that's pretty scary when you look at almost four-fifths of Americans not hearing about climate change or global warming at all on a weekly basis. And the other thing that I think is concerning as I look through the numbers is this sort of invincibility complex that Americans seem to have about the risks posed by global warming, which is 70% of people in the U.S. believe that global warming is going to hurt plants and animals around the world. That's great, because it will, and it already is. 62%, though, believe it will hurt people in developing countries. Only 58% of people think global warming will hurt people in the United States. And only 41% think global warming will harm them personally. So the closer this issue gets to you, the more you think I'm insulated from this. It's not something I need to worry about. Maybe I can, people in the developing world are vulnerable because they're poor and they face diseases that I don't. But this is still this severe insulation of the risk of climate change, believing it's not going to come and impact me, I think is probably discouraging action or people pushing from action on this issue. So I
fascinating
see,
stuff.
It is worrisome as you look at that perceived risk getting less and less as it comes closer to the person answering the questions.
Yeah. And in our remaining 40 seconds here, I wanted to get into Saudi Arabia. This is a big deal in my mind. Canada has called out Saudi Arabia's human rights records. Saudi Arabia is trashing Canada for that. Is the United States going to defend Canada or are we going to defend Saudi Arabia?
Well, by our silence on human rights, we will probably defend by proxy the Saudis, though I don't think we're going to wade into this one, given the fact that the Saudis have called off all business dealings with Canadians. They've revoked 18,000 scholarships for students to study abroad in Canada. The ambassadors have been recalled. I think the 10-second conclusion here is that we might see Mohammed bin Salman pursuing reform to try and increase business in the country, but he's not going to be more tolerant of any dissent against that country's human rights policy. So that's actually going to make his broader economic ambitions, I think, difficult in the years to come.
Yeah, and you look at what he's doing in Yemen, for example, it seems like he's just really committed to autocracy. I think a lot of people were hoping he'd be in favor of a little bit of democracy, but apparently not. Luke, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. We'll be back. We're going to check in with Jamal Abdi of the National Iranian American Council right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.